Welcome to the Duke University Philosophy, Politics, and Economics Lecture Series for 2011. I'm Michael Munger, Director of the PPE program at Duke. This series is made possible by the generous support of Duke University, the Thomas W. Smith Foundation, and the Charles G. Koch Foundation. These speeches are in the public domain, but any use of this material must clearly identify the source, as both the name and affiliation of the particular speaker, as well as the Duke PPE program. We hope that you enjoy these lectures as much as the audiences did.
All right, well, it's a pleasure to introduce the final speaker in the Charles G. Koch Foundation speaker series for this fall. Professor Kevin Greer from the University of Oklahoma has published widely on macroeconomics, econometrics, and monetary policy, and is going to talk to us today about monetary policy. Professor Greer.
I would thank you all for coming, but I understand that you get extra credit, so I guess I'll thank the Scarbecks and Bill. They're not getting any extra credit. I'm glad to be here, and my talk today is going to be about U.S. monetary policy, past, present, and future. Please ask questions along the way. No need to save them for the end. I'm happy to try to address questions as we go along. Okay. And let me just give you an outline of the talk. Talk a little bit about the background of the Federal Reserve, how they actually conduct monetary policy, what we mean by monetary policy, sort of the nuts and bolts a little bit. Try to evaluate the historical performance of the Fed. Try to talk some about the financial crisis that we're still dealing with the remnants of, and did the Fed have responsibility there? Was the Fed a force for good or for ill there? We'll talk a little bit about everybody's favorite topic. Should we abolish the Fed? And then I'll talk a little bit, if we have time at the end, especially about challenges the Fed has going forward. All right. Now I'm going to try another technical impossibility. My joke's already up there, sorry. I'm an economist, so I've outsourced part of my presentation to John Stewart, but that actually has to come up now. So I have no idea how to do that.
Our economy has been guided by the Federal Reserve Bank, which is now engaged in a $1 trillion-plus program to prop up the economy called quantitative easing. It's not made up phrase, if that's what you're thinking. It's when the Fed buys up government debt with money that they make out of thin air. Sounds like it's printing money. Nuh-uh.
One myth that's out there is that what we're doing is printing money. We're not printing money.
See? As Ben Bernanke is chairman of the Fed, we're not printing money. We're imagineering money. Printing money would be like last year when we were making things quantitatively easier for banks by buying up massive amounts of their debt using money created from thin air. That was pretty money. Don't take my word for it. Take it out of the exact same beer, on the exact same show, talking to the exact same interviewer, not 21 months ago.
To lend to a bank, we simply use the computer to mark up the size of the account that they have with the Fed. So it's much more akin, although not exactly the same, but it's much more akin to printing money than it is to borrowing.
You've been printing money.
Well, effectively, and we need to do that.
What? I guess Bernanke was looking at the average age of a 60 Minutes viewer, if anyone who saw it last year is dead now. Just admit it, Bernanke, you're a guy with a beard who's allowed to print money, which makes you look smarter and more powerful than people who can't print money and don't have beards. Frankly, I tried growing a beard. That's my power of information. It's the ability to print money. That's the thing. So go ahead, then. Print money. Aside from Zimbabwe-like hyperinflation, what could go wrong?
A printing problem has forced the government to put more than 1 billion brand-new $100 bills into storage. Production has been halted until a fix is figured out.
Are you me? Now we can't even print money? That was the last thing we were good at. What happened?
Apparently the printing process, which incorporates high-tech features like 3D security strips, color-shifting images, is so complex that it's causing bills to crease and fold during production.
We've outsmarted ourselves with our own fancy security measures to the point where our money is committing suicide. I hope we still remember our passwords. Or at least the answers to the security question prompts. Ooh, what's our country's maiden name?
Great Britain, I believe.
So apparently the only way to fix the economy is to print money, but we can't print money. The only way the story could get worse is if it somehow also added to global warming.
It will take more than a year to sift through those piles of cash and find the bad bills, which will be taken out and burned.
In outdoor fires in front of homeless people.
So, I'm going to try to be a little bit clearer than Chairman Ben Bernanke. Is the Fed printing money? Yes, definitely. Are they doing it on a printing press? No, that's the Treasury. The Fed prints money electronically. Right? Obviously, I wouldn't be able to do it with my electronic skills, but the Fed has guys like Joe that can print money, and that's exactly perfect. That's exactly what they're doing. Okay. So, we get the idea that monetary policy is controversial and a little bit confusing when we have the Chairman of the Fed saying two different things within a year and a half on the exact same TV show, okay? And we get the feeling that maybe monetary policy is political when we realize maybe the reason why he changed saying what he was saying was because of political fallout and political pressure and political unhappiness on the part of some members of the government of saying that the Fed is printing money. All right. So let's talk a little bit before we get into monetary policy. Let's just talk a little about exactly what is the Federal Reserve. All right. So the Fed is made up of a board of governors that sits in Washington, D.C., has seven members when it's full. It hasn't been full for quite a while. And they're appointed by the president and approved by the Senate, just like any sort of cabinet-level position would be appointed and approved. There are also 12 regional Federal Reserve banks. And this little map here shows the 12 different regions. You guys are over here in Region 5. Your bank Fed is at the Richmond Fed. I live way the heck out here in Region 10. My bank is the Kansas City Fed. Okay. The Federal Open Market Committee, this is the committee that sets monetary policy, that makes the decisions about what's going to happen. It's comprised of the members of the Board of Governors and five members of the presidents of the regional banks. Those guys rotate around. The president of the New York Fed is always on there because the New York Fed historically has conducted the mechanics of monetary policy historically, and then the other guys rotate around. Politically, recently, this has become somewhat controversial. Retiring politician Barney Frank was very strong in suggesting that we needed to get these guys off. We needed these reserve regional bank presidents off the Federal Open Market Committee because nobody confirmed them, nobody appointed them, and they're just business people and things like that, and they don't really, not many of them are economists, and they don't belong setting the nation's monetary policy. Okay. So that's the Fed, the structure of the Fed. What's the Fed supposed to do? Well, when it was created in 1913, it had this somewhat opaque mission. This is all it says in the law creating the Fed about what they're supposed to do. Furnish an elastic currency, establish a more effective supervision of banking in the United States and for other purposes. If you're like, what does that mean? Good question, right? It doesn't literally mean anything about what we think about as modern monetary policy. It doesn't say the words inflation aren't in there, the words unemployment aren't in there, the words economic growth are not in there. Right, the words fairness and lending are not in there, any of that. In 1977, Congress amended the Federal Reserve Act to give them what economists call the dual mandate. They have two different goals. Long-run growth of monetary and credit aggregates to do two things. One, increase production to get maximum employment and stable prices. It also says moderate interest rates. Most economists focus on these two things in policy discussions. So they're supposed to do two things at once. Stable prices, no inflation, and maximum employment, very low unemployment. I don't know if any of you guys are baseball fans, but baseball managers are famous for going out to the mound and giving pitchers unhelpful advice. Like a manager will go out to the mound and tell the pitcher, don't walk the guy, but don't give him anything good to hit either. Right? So don't throw him a ball and don't throw him a strike. And that's essentially what this is saying. Right? Don't create any inflation, but make sure that we have full employment. So it always leaves some avenue for politicians to beat up on the Fed. If inflation is low and unemployment is relatively high, like it is now, then we say they're not doing enough, they have the dual mandate, they've forgotten about unemployment, and they need to focus on that. If we have the opposite situation with relatively low unemployment and high inflation, then they're ignoring their mandate for stable prices. So it's kind of can be a no-win situation for the Fed. I'd like to just turn now and talk about how the Fed actually conducts monetary policy. So there's these 12 guys on the Open Market Committee. This is their mandate from Congress. How do they go about doing it? Federal Reserve uses open market operations, printing money, okay, to affect the amount of reserves that are in the banking system, and their target is the interest rate that's charged on reserves in the banking system. Okay? So an open market operation is simply the Fed tries to target what's called the federal funds rate, which is the rate that banks charge each other to lend and borrow reserves between banks. So it's an intra-bank rate, it's an overnight rate, it's a very short-run interest rate. Okay? So this is the Fed's tool, essentially, is they can buy and sell assets and electronically. So the way the Fed prints money is they buy a bunch of government bonds from Citibank. And the way they pay Citibank is electronically pushing a button and creating a credit on Citibank's account at the Fed. So Citibank now has this money, bank reserves, that they can use to make loans or whatever they want to do with. And the Fed has taken that asset that Citibank has sold them, put it on their balance sheet on the asset side. The liability side is the credit they created, okay? And that's what we mean by printing money. So if the Fed wants the Fed funds rate to go down, they would pump more reserves into the system. That way there would be a lot more reserves and the interest rate you'd have to be charged to borrow and then would be lower. The way the Fed puts more reserves in the system is to buy assets that banks are holding. Assets like treasury bills. In the financial crisis, banks were buying assets of foreign banks, they were buying mortgages, they were buying a lot of different assets. Traditionally, the assets that the Fed buys are U.S. government debt, okay, which banks hold a lot of. All right. So the idea is that these open market operations affect interest rates, and then interest rates affect the economy. Okay, relating back to the dual mandate, if inflation is running higher than the Fed wants, they would sell assets and reduce reserves, raising interest rates and trying to slow down inflation in the economy. Okay? Questions about this? This is like you're now ready for the midterm in a money and banking class, so that's pretty good, but hopefully that's at least somewhat clear. Let's talk a little bit about how the Fed has done in their job evaluating the Fed's performance. Okay? And I want to break this up into different historical time periods. The Fed was founded in 1913. So from 1913 to World War II, a good part of that time, the United States was on what was called the gold standard, which meant that the dollar was convertible into gold at a price of 35 dollars an ounce. Okay? And that then constrains a lot of the ability of the Fed to do open market operations and manipulate reserves and things like that. Right? Because people could take their paper money theoretically, and convert it back into gold. So the amount of gold held by the government put some sort of limit on the amount of monetary expansion or monetary printing that the Fed could do. On the plus side for the Fed during this gold standard period, it's pretty clear that they've reduced seasonal fluctuations in the money supply and possibly reduced the volatility of the business cycle. On the minus side, and this is a really, really, really big minus, right? On the minus side, the Fed was in charge during the Great Depression. The worst economic downturn, the most protracted and long-lasting economic downturn that we've suffered in the United States. The Fed existed at that time. The Fed was undertaking policies at that time. And many economists, I guess blame is a strong word, but many economists blame the Fed for how long the Depression lasted and how severe it was. The same bearded genius that we saw, Ben Bernanke, spoke a few years ago before Milton Friedman died at Milton Friedman's 90th birthday party, and he actually admitted it. He said, turned to Milton Friedman, looked him in the eye and said, Milton, you were right. We caused the Depression. We messed up. We did it wrong, and we'll never make that mistake again. And I will say on the plus side, they didn't make that mistake again when it came to 2007. Right, I think it was a good thing that Bernanke was Fed chair at that time. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. After the war, we were on sort of a pseudo-gold standard, okay, the Bretton Woods era. In the Bretton Woods era, countries' currencies were linked directly to the dollar. They had fixed exchange rates with the United States. their currencies were supposed to be convertible into dollar, and the dollar was still supposed to be converted into gold. So the Bretton Woods era is another era when the Fed really didn't have a tremendous amount of monetary discretion. Okay? But the system still had built-in constraints. We think about the modern Fed. We're really thinking about the Fed from the end of the Bretton Woods system, from 1973 to the present. Okay. And if we want to just sort of break up that period into two or three different epochs, we know in the 1970s and early 1980s, we had a macroeconomic regime where inflation was relatively high, above 10%, which in the United States is extremely high. Unemployment was relatively high. Output growth was sluggish. The term stagflation, an odd term that macroeconomists have coined for both high inflation and sluggish output growth, came about. That term was coined exactly in this era. In 1980, Ronald Reagan became president. The Republicans took over the Senate, and Paul Volcker, who had recently been appointed Fed chair in 1979, that group of people declared war on inflation, engineered a sharp decline in inflation, a very deep recession, and we ended up in an era of much lower inflation. So this is the inflation rate in the U.S. graphed here. Okay, here is the high inflation of the 1970s. Here is the strong disinflation in the early 1980s associated with Paul Volcker. And then this is the period that's referred to as the Great Moderation in macroeconomics. You can see how volatile the inflation rate was before that and how sort of low and stable it is after that. So macroeconomists have this very unfortunate habit of declaring victory when things look well or going well for a little while. Back in the 1960s when John Kennedy was president, the meme in macro was that we've conquered the business cycle. That turned out not to be true. In the 1990s, again, the same thing. Like, Greenspan was the maestro. Bernanke was his assistant. The Fed knew exactly what to do. We were in this era of the Great Moderation, and everything was great. And we know what happened was, in 2007, all hell broke loose in the financial crisis, and it turned out that we weren't in any period of Great Moderation, and the Fed didn't have a handle on what was going on. If we look at output growth, so this is output growth. This starts a little bit later in 1950. Okay? You can see, again, in the 50s and 60s, output growth is relatively volatile. You can see these negative lines are recessions. You can see here the big recession in the early 1980s that was associated with the strong decline in inflation when Reagan and Volcker decided that enough was enough and we were going to get to a low inflation regime. And then you can see the era after that through here in the 90s and into the early 2000s. There's one recession here. It's pretty small compared to these other ones. There's a long period of no recessions. There's these little itty-bitty ones here, and then we get out to modern times. Questions? Comments? Yes?
So the policy in the 80s of decreasing inflation, did that cause the deep recession, or are they related at all?
Sure. So macroeconomists will argue over everything and anything.
No, they won't.
So I can't make statements. Anytime you hear someone say, like, all economists agree or all macroeconomists agree, right, they're not telling the truth. Most mainstream sort of macro people would agree that if people's expectations are fixed in a certain way, that in the short run there's going to be a trade-off between inflation and unemployment. If the Federal Reserve reduces inflation in a way that the public is not expecting, or even if they announce that they're going to reduce inflation but the public doesn't believe them because there's been high inflation in the past, then people will have expectations of future wage increases. They will be bargaining for their future wages to be higher, right? But if inflation is cut, then those wages are unrealistically high. So we end up with a situation where we would see in the short run a trade-off between inflation and unemployment. That's, for those of you who've had some economics, I don't know if you had, that's called the Phillips curve. There was a British economist in the 1950s that noticed a historical regularity in the chalk between inflation and unemployment. When inflation historically was high in the 1800s and early 1900s, unemployment was low and vice versa. In the 1960s and 1970s, economists believed that was a menu that you could pick from. You could choose the inflation-unemployment combination that you wanted. It turned out that wasn't quite right either. But yeah, the idea was that we raised interest rates really high, we cut back money growth, that reduced inflation, relatively quickly, but at the cost of a prolonged recession, a very steep recession with very high unemployment. The argument would be if people had believed the Fed that they were going to do it exactly in the way they did it and had adapted their forward-looking behavior to match the Fed's announcement, that maybe the recession wouldn't have been so bad, maybe it could have been avoided. But it's hard for the Fed to have credibility that we're going to produce low inflation in the future. Right? If I've been doing this right for 15 years and I tell you, oh wait, starting tomorrow, no inflation, it's not really that surprising that people didn't believe the Fed right away. We'll see today, people are arguing that the Fed should do exactly the opposite. The people are arguing today that the Fed should promise to create inflation in the future to help us get out of our current recession. But that's also a promise that would be unlikely that people would believe. We'll talk about that at the end. Okay. So, other questions? All right. So let's talk then, did the Fed cause the 2007 crisis, right? There are a lot of politicians that love to blame the Fed. The Fed generally just shuts up and takes it, right? They don't fight back. So this question is asked a lot, okay? My answer, my personal answer is no, it didn't cause the crisis, but it did contribute to the proximate cause of the crisis, which was the huge run-up in housing prices that we saw. And the way I'd like to try to explain this to you is to try to talk briefly about the way that monetary economists evaluate Fed policy, or most monetary economists evaluate Fed policy, and that's what this thing called the Taylor Rule. The Taylor Rule is just an equation that says how should the Fed set their federal funds rate. So the Fed's policy is to buy and sell reserves in order to hit this federal funds rate. This is John Taylor, the Taylor Rule, suggestion of the optimal or the best way to set monetary policy. So if inflation rises, we should increase interest rates by more than the rate of inflation. And if output falls below potential output, if the economy starts to sag, then we should also, I'm sorry, if output rises above potential output, excuse me, the economy is overheating, then we should also raise interest rates. But the reaction to inflation should be stronger than the reaction to overheating real economy. So if we have this, we can graph a theoretical optimal or neutral path for interest rates and compare that to what the Fed actually did. Okay? And if we do that, okay, this is for the United States over here, and the graph looks very smooth because interest rates have been smoothed out. So this is the actual path of the Fed funds rate in the 2000s in the US. And this dark blue line is the smooth path of the Fed funds rate should have followed if the Fed was using this rule. Okay? So the idea is that the Fed lowered interest rates and kept them too low relative to the state of the economy for the years end of 2001, 2002, 2003, well into 2004. When they finally started raising interest rates, they did so slowly and in steps, and it took them like a year and a half to finally get up to what this Taylor Rule is saying is the right policy. Okay. So the idea here is that overly expansive or too low of interest rates, or really expansive monetary policy, was what the Fed was doing when we saw the housing market really take off and housing prices really grow dramatically. We'll show a graph of that a little bit later. The Fed wasn't the only central bank that did this. This is the same concept graph for the European Central Bank. Okay? The blue line is the actual setting. I'm sorry, the blue line is the optimal setting of the interest rate for the ECB, or the policy rate for the ECB, and the yellow line is the actual setting. And again, you can see in the 2000s, the European Central Bank was consistently running a monetary policy that was overly expansionary, right? That was too loose. Interest rates were too low. And this idea is that cheap credit is what helped to fuel a lot of borrowing and a lot of investing, speculatively investing in assets, causing the prices of those assets to rapidly rise, and that didn't last. Questions or comments here about this? Please.
Isn't the ECB supposed to be following the Taylor type rule?
The ECB doesn't have a dual mandate like the Fed. The ECB has a mandate that says inflation should be no more than 2%, should be right around 2%. So the ECB has an inflation target, which is different from the Fed, which doesn't have any specific numerical targets. They just have the impossible dream, the dual mandate, stable prices and full employment. And the ECB has a mandate for low inflation. That's written right into their, into the Constitution or into the rules that, that created the ECB. This is causing a lot of political angst in Europe right now. Every day we see in the paper politicians in Germany and France saying the ECB needs to act as a lender of last resort, buy up tons of government bonds and things like that, and the ECB is saying that's not our job. So if the Fed didn't cause the crisis, maybe they sort of contributed a little bit, but they didn't cause the crisis. I'd like to ask a different question. Did the Fed save us? In 2007 and 2008, where things were really, really bad, and the Fed was doing really, really a lot of stuff, was it good? Was it bad? Did they do the right thing? Did they do the wrong thing? And my opinion is, my belief is, that they more or less kind of did the right thing. Mike and I used to argue, Mike and I used to argue about that quite a bit, him saying they did the wrong thing and me the right, but I think he might kind of agree with me now. He does. The Fed set the Fed funds rate, boom, very close to zero, just left it there. They lent out funds very generously. They lent out to European banks, they lent out to American banks, they took collateral for the loans as they're required to do, but they took pretty shaky stuff as collateral, not the highest quality of assets. They used quantitative easing, which John Stewart was talking about, printing money, to try to further stimulate the economy. The difference between quantitative easing and normal open market operations is normal open market operations are where the Fed buys and sells U.S. government debt. Quantitative easing is where the Fed would buy and sell possibly different assets, more mortgages that have been securitized, longer-term debt, things like that. And Bernanke was also instrumental in working with the Treasury to try and get Congress to pass the troubled asset relief package, the TARP package, which was injecting money directly into banks. If we want to see what the Fed actually did, this graph over here is a graph of what we would call the asset side of the Fed's balance sheet. This is the total assets of the Federal Reserve. You can see at the beginning of 2007, it's going along here at about $850 billion. All right, that sounds like a lot of money, but here's the crisis. Here's 2008 when Lehman Brothers is collapsing and when financial markets are freezing up. And you can see the Fed's balance sheet shoots up to over $2 trillion. What does that mean? It means the Fed bought $1.2 trillion in assets. Right, how did they pay for those assets? By printing money electronically. Right, they just credited the seller's account with the money to pay for the assets that they were buying. Okay? The financial institutions that were selling these assets needed liquidity. No one would loan them money. The financial markets were sort of frozen up. The Fed stepped in, bought the assets that weren't trading in the private market, and put liquidity, put reserves, put money into the financial system. In a way, that's what we mean when we say a bank would act as a lender of last resort. Right? The private market had stopped lending, private financial markets weren't functioning, and the Fed stepped in and created a tremendous amount of liquidity, you know, really dramatically changed their balance sheet. This long rise here, where we go from like $2.5 trillion up to almost $3 trillion. This is the quantitative easing period in 2010 that John Stewart was talking about at the beginning part of the video. This is where the Fed is buying longer-term assets and as slowly as an organized program doing it incrementally over time. This was emergency, right? This was, there's a fire, this was, you know, things are in really bad shape, and the Fed just pumped money into the economy. I mean, that's not really that easy to do. So the Fed did a lot in that regard. We could also talk about the Fed as a lender of last resort for specific financial institutions. Sorry for showing what I'm going to talk about next. This graph's a little bit more complicated. Let me explain it to you. This is the stock price of Morgan Stanley Bank. Okay. This is the financial crisis 2008, that same point when the Fed's balance sheet shot straight up. This is how much money the Fed was loaning to Morgan Stanley Bank. You can see up here, it's like what, $125 billion? Right. But the interesting thing is, if you think of the amount the Fed is loaning relative to the market capitalization of the firm, it's something like 700% of their market capitalization. Okay. So the Fed made a decision that these banks weren't bankrupt, they simply were caught in this liquidity crunch, right? The financial markets just weren't lending any money. There was so much uncertainty after Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers that there were no lending going on in private markets. Even agents with good collateral, with safe assets, couldn't get loans, couldn't get liquidity. and the Fed stepped in and really poured money into these financial institutions. Now, there are a lot of people who say that was a horrible thing, that they should let them fail. Right? I don't agree with that point of view. I think that this was probably a good action by the Fed. Certainly is Bernanke living up to his word to the late Milton Friedman that we're not going to let what happened in the Great Depression happen again. What happened in the Great Depression was we had a liquidity crisis, banks started failing. Banks started failing, people were in line to get their money out of the bank, they couldn't get their money out of the bank, and banks collapsed and the whole banking system went down for quite a while. All right. Questions about this, about what the Fed's doing, what we mean by the Fed's balance sheet, by the Fed increasing its assets, what we mean by the Fed acting as a lender of last resort in emergency situations. Wow, I must be giving an awesome lecture. That's great. Okay. So let's take another point of view that you often hear about. So we've talked about, did the Fed cause the crisis? I think they contributed but didn't really cause it. Did the Fed save us from Armageddon, from catastrophe, from a complete and total meltdown of the financial system in 2008? Yeah, I think the Fed saved us. I really do. Should we abolish the Fed? Here's from my neighboring state, Ron Paul, congressman. Here's famous libertarian. Here's the second most famous libertarian in the world is right here. And I'm quoting the first most famous libertarian in the world right here. Okay. Ron Paul hates the Fed, right? He hates the Fed with a passion. He thinks everything that's wrong with this world, from global warming to you name it, is the problem of the Fed. And if we just get rid of the Fed and get back on the gold standard, everything would be great. It's a little bit of a simplistic view. But he says, Americans have suffered a steadily eroding purchasing power because of the Fed's inflationary policies. The stagflation in the 70s, which we've talked about, the dot-com bubble, which we'll talk about in the future, in the future in this talk, right? All these problems can be traced to the Fed. And that what the Fed should do, what the Congress should do, is take back control of monetary policy, get rid of the Fed, abolish the Fed, and Congress' constitutional mandate should only permit currency backed by stable commodities, silver and gold, back to the gold standard, is what Ron Paul wants. No Fed, no discretionary policy, no lender of last resort, nobody who could do this in a crunch. Okay. That's what he wants. This is a graph from like ronpaul.com, and this is a famous graph that people of this point of view will often show. It's the value of a dollar from 1913, a dollar was worth a dollar, and then with accumulated increases in prices or with inflation, how much would that dollar buy you today? Okay. And the answer is about 10 cents. Okay, so from the creation of the Fed till, when does this end, 2005, say? We haven't had a ton of inflation since 2005, so maybe we're only down to like 8 cents at this point. The value of the dollar has fallen about 90%. This is what he means by inflation is eroding the purchasing power of America, inflation is destroying America, and things like that. It's not a very good argument because, yes, a dollar is worth less than it used to be, but on the other side, everybody has a heck of a lot more dollars than they did back then. In 1949, the hourly wage of manufacturing was $1.25 an hour. Right? In 2011, the average hourly wage of manufacturing is like $19 an hour. Okay? So yeah, you know, money has fallen, the value of the money has fallen by like 80%, but wages have risen by about the same amount. So that's sort of a strange argument that we should abolish the Fed because of this. Right? The question is, what has happened to people's living standards? Not what's happened to the value of the dollar. What's happened to people's living standards and standards of living over this time? So here's a graph of manufacturing wages. In 1949, that's $1.26. In 2011, it's well over $18. Okay. So you can see these things. People do this a lot. If you think about, like, how many hours of labor does an average manufacturing worker have to work to buy a car? Right? And we know that's fallen dramatically. Even though prices have risen due to inflation, both productivity has raised living standards quite a bit. The other thing that's sort of funny about Paul's statement is that we should only let currency be backed by stable commodities such as silver and gold be used as legal tender. So that would say that the price of gold should be stable. The value of gold should be stable. Okay. This is a graph of the value of the price of gold. Now, I didn't graph it against the dollar, right, which Ron Paul hates, the dollar, because he just say that's bouncing around because the dollar is going into the toilet. So I picked the strongest currency that I know, the Japanese yen. I could use, if you use the Swiss franc, it looks exactly the same. So this is the Japanese yen. Japan hasn't had any inflation, right? We're more worried about deflation in Japan than inflation. So the movement around in this graph isn't due to changes in the Japanese price level. This is due to changes in supply and demand of gold. It starts here in 2007 at a little about 70,000 yen per ounce of gold and ends up at 135,000 yen per ounce of gold. Gold's not a stable commodity. The price of gold isn't stable. The price of gold's instability is not because of the value of the dollar falling. It's because it's a speculative commodity and there can be really dramatic price swings like this one, and so on. So Ron Paul, he's Dr. Ron Paul, right? But he's not an economist. He's actually a OBGYN. So if Dr. Ron Paul was in my economics class, I would give him like a D- on his monetary economics. Questions or comments about this? Yes?
Thinking from a less extreme view, can it be said that the value of life here in America would be greater if the dollar was not devalued? I mean, you talk about how there's this large economic disparity. I mean, it seems as if that even though it may not be ruining America, it's still just kind of maintaining some sort of strange status quo that could be better.
Okay, so I think that's a very good question. I think I sort of heard two different things there. One would be, does inflation have much to do with the distribution of income and the income inequality that we see and we worry about and we think is growing in America? And the other is, yeah, we're doing well, but could we have done even better, say, if we were on a gold standard or something like that? And I think those are really valid questions. Okay, I don't have an answer that I'm comfortable saying this is the right answer because there are questions that are really being strongly debated. I would say that we've seen, even as inflation has gotten lower and more stable and more moderate in the United States, we've seen income inequality grow and grow. Right during that period of the Great Moderation in the 80s and 90s, that's the really the period where we start to see income inequality get larger and larger and larger. So those trends are actually going in the opposite direction to a certain extent. Inflation has stabilized and income inequality has taken off. There's an interesting question, right? If we were on a gold standard, would we just not have any problems, right? Would the economy implicitly or explicitly be more stable? And would we not have to worry about having a lender of last resort because we wouldn't get into these issues? Now, on one side, we could say, well, the Fed wouldn't really be able to keep interest rates lower than an optimal policy rule for 3 years. So that would be a plus for being on the gold standard. On the other hand, we were on a gold standard during the Great Depression. Right, the Great Depression happened while the U.S. was on a gold standard with literal conversion of gold. You could literally take your paper money and go in and come out with gold bars. Okay? So it's definitely not the case that a gold standard would insulate the economy from severe downturns and severe financial problems. But I can see both sides of the question, right? And in a way, you know, it's like there's definitely, I think, a trade-off there. Do we want to have an organization that's somewhat independent of politics in the short run, that's there to act as a lender of last resort, as a liquidity provider in extreme emergencies, right? And if we do want that, it seems like, at least historically, we're going to have to put up with an institution that day-to-day makes some mistakes, keeps policy too loose for too long, things like that. The really main point that I want to make here, for just a solid point where I feel very comfortable making it, is that this is just wrong, right? The Fed's not to blame for everything. America's not a terrible place. The living standards of average Americans haven't been eroded since the Fed has been in power. They've actually increased dramatically. Okay? Your questions are much more thoughtful, right? And I think they're very valid. And it's, you know, it's an open question. I think you could come down either way on that kind of thing. Tying to the gold standard would not make the value of the U.S. dollar stable. That's the point I'm trying to make here, right? Gold, the price of gold moves a lot, and if we were tied to gold 1-to-1, this would be our exchange rate, right, moving around. Was there a question in the back that I see hand? Yes?
What about the idea that the Fed allows us to kind of engage in perpetual war? So it kind of finances, we just put on the credit card and just going to war and the kind of cost to society. So whereas if we were backed by the gold standard, we wouldn't be able to.
Okay. Okay, so the question is, does the Fed buying government debt or monetizing the deficit, does that allow us to have sort of a free lunch and do stuff that maybe we don't like. Right? Like a more liberal, progressive person might say the wars. Maybe an extreme right-wing person would say welfare. I don't know. But the idea that the Fed is somehow financing government expenditure, that is that kind of what you're asking? Yeah. So compared to a lot of less well-run countries than the United States, and there actually are a lot of countries that are less well-run than us, the Fed doesn't really directly monetize or directly buy up government debt as a matter of policy. In the early 1950s, the Fed was subservient to the Treasury. The Fed had as a goal, as an intermediate goal, that they would buy up enough issuance of government debt to keep the interest rate on government debt relatively low and stable. In 1953, the Fed and the Treasury reached an agreement where the Fed was no longer obligated to do that. Okay? When we say the Fed is buying and selling government securities, they're mostly doing that on a cyclical basis, right? No one really expects the Fed to keep that $3 trillion balance sheet forever. They expect that sooner or later they will unwind that position, sell those assets back into the private market, and come back down again. There are a lot of countries in the world where the central bank is subservient to the Treasury and is a financing arm of the federal government. That's not so much the case here. These big asset purchases that we've seen are historically unprecedented and presumably temporary. And when we talk about challenges facing the Fed, it's going to be a challenge for the Fed to get rid of all those assets. And I want to talk about that here at the end. Other questions at this point? Okay. So I'm close to the end, which is good for you guys. Future challenges. So just what we were just talking about. What's the Fed going to do with their balance sheet? Okay. Reason why this is tricky, remember I showed you that graph of the total assets of the Fed? They shot straight up in 2008 and then meandered up after that. This is a graph of what's called excess reserves. In the banking system, banks are required to keep a certain fraction of their assets and not make loans on them as reserves, so that if people like want their money back, then the banks have this reserves to make payments and things like that. What happened when the Fed was pumping liquidity into the system? It didn't really stimulate economic activity because banks weren't turning around. Banks were using that money to loan to each other, but they were not turning around and making more loans to businesses or consumers, right? It's hard to get a loan now even if you have good credit and things like that. You could see like excess reserves, this is 200 billion. So excess reserves are really small, just a few billion. And that makes sense in normal times because an excess reserve is a reserve you could be lending out and making money on that you're not, that you're keeping for safety. So what's happened in the US banking system is a tremendous amount. Now, the Fed's balance sheet is up to about 2.8 trillion, and this is only about 1.7 trillion. Okay? So there's a trillion that made it out of excess reserves. But of the money that they pumped in, a tremendous amount of it stayed in the banking system and not being used as loans. Okay? So had to get an OU plug in there sooner or later. Right? This will, you know, we would expect in normal times if banks decide to start lending out money, they're sitting on all these excess reserves. Right, the money supply could increase dramatically, and we might worry that these excess reserves getting into the economy would be a problem with inflation. So the Fed has to figure out, how are we going to unwind this extreme asset position that we've taken, this expansion of our balance sheet, in a way that isn't too dramatic and hurts economic activity, or too slow and allows there to be inflation. And that's a real problem for them that they're working on, and economists are writing papers on this and trying to figure it out. But one reason why that extreme expansionary policy that the Fed undertook didn't really do much for output growth and to reduce unemployment and things like that, and didn't create much inflation, which Mike was sure that it was going to do, was because banks have been sitting on a tremendous amount of it. Okay. Because they don't have good enough expectations about loans or enough optimism about loans that they think they'll be repaid and that they'll make money, they're just parking the money here. A strange thing that the Fed did at this time was the Fed decided to start paying interest on reserves, which is sort of counterproductive if they're trying to get these new liquidity out into the economy to stimulate economic activity. The Fed now pays banks interest on the reserves they hold at the Fed, which they didn't used to do. And that's for sure, right? There's no risk to that. You get that money for sure because the Fed's just printing it. The Fed just prints you the money to pay you the interest, right? So that's for sure. So that's a kind of a weird thing that the Fed did, which I don't have a real explanation for why they thought that was a good idea. But they are also, they're paying interest on that, and that at the margin as well is holding back people from that. Another challenge for the Fed is we have this feeling, right, that our economy is beset by or bedeviled by or pestered by asset bubbles. Where we talk about the dot-com bubble, the housing bubble. It's like a joke now. Everything's a bubble. Okay? So that's an issue of the Fed. What should they do? Asset prices don't really show up in our regular measures of inflation. Housing is in there, but what housing measure of housing that goes into the price level is essentially what's called owner equivalent rent. It's a measure of rental costs. Okay? The value of houses aren't built into the price indexes that the Fed uses to track inflation. So when housing prices shot up, right, the inflation rate, what the Fed's supposed to be interested in inflation, doesn't shoot up as much because housing is in the consumer price index, but it's in there as rent equivalent. It's in there as what would it cost to rent an average house. And that price, rental prices, didn't rise nearly as much as housing prices had. If the Fed had had retail prices of houses in the price index that they were using to measure inflation, then inflation would have been a lot higher, and maybe the Fed would have put the brakes on the economy a little bit sooner, or not have run as an expansionary policy as they had. So the question is, should the Fed just target traditional inflation, or should the Fed look at big increases in asset prices and view those as somewhat inflationary and view those as things that they should try to deal with? We can take a look at what I'm talking about. So this is the housing prices. This is the Case-Shiller U.S. House Price Index. It goes all the way back to the 1880s, normalized here at 100. And here we go from like 110 to just about 200. So the index almost doubles, right, in this period in the late 1990s and early 2000s. Okay. That's what we mean by a bubble, right? Nothing's happened. Here's the depression, right? We get back up to normal again. We're sitting around here. We have a couple mini things. And then we have like the mother of all asset price explosions here. Right? And the idea is of the Fed targeting asset bubbles is the idea is the Fed looks at this, they say, this doesn't seem right. This is a problem. We need to try to undertake policy to slow down this growth rate. Right? Why? Well, the growth rate is great, right? No one has any problem with that. What people have a problem with, right, it's not the fall, it's the sudden stop. What people have a problem with is the downside here, right? This huge collapse in prices, right, where tens of trillions of dollars of wealth that people think they have disappear in a few months. So it's urged on the Fed by a lot of analysts that they should consider things more broadly than just like the consumer price index or the deflator for GDP as their measure of inflation, right, that there could be inflation in asset prices. The housing price bubble here was a great example of that. We also had earlier in the 90s and in the 1990s and in the early 2000s what was called the dot-com bubble, the tech stock bubble. Right, we were in the age of the new economy and the and tech stocks were. So this is the NASDAQ, which is an over-the-counter dealer broker set of exchanges of stocks, and it's very tech-heavy compared to, say, the Dow Jones or something like that. So we see this huge run-up in this tech-heavy stock index from something like around 800 to up something like about 5,000, right, throughout the 1990s. And this is the boom that like fueled the Clinton era, the prosperity of the Clinton era, right? It was this huge increase in wealth coming from people that own tech stocks. And again, we see the same thing, right? This is rising really rapidly. Stock prices are not in any appreciable way in conventional measures of inflation. So if the Fed is looking at inflation, making sure measured inflation doesn't get too high, this is irrelevant to them. Okay? The argument would be, man, if we see something shooting off like this that's historically unprecedented, maybe that's not the new wave of the future. Maybe this isn't going to do this forever. Maybe this is a bubble, and maybe we should do something to try to slow things down. Okay, and we did see, again, a relatively rapid and severe collapse in technology stocks in the late 1990s and early 2000s. Some people disagree, right, that we should target bubbles. Recession-plagued nation demands new bubble to invest in. This is actually from The Onion, so don't get too bent out of shape about the analysis here, right? But A panel of business leaders testified that we need to find a new irresponsible and illusory economic bubble in which to invest. Right? Some people have argued that the American economy today, growth in the American economy today, is coming from these bubbles. Right? The dot-com bubble fueled the prosperity in the Clinton era. The housing bubble fueled the prosperity in the Shrub era, George Bush the second era. And what we need now, we don't need reforms, we don't need solid things, we just need another bubble. Okay? The last challenge that I want to talk about for monetary policy is this idea called the zero-bound problem. Okay? Remember earlier in the talk I talked about the Taylor rule, which was we would take the rate of inflation and the output gap and use that to predict what policy interest rate would be the best interest rate. We have inflation so low and output gap so big that if you do a Taylor rule with today's economic variables, it predicts a negative policy interest rate. Fed is good. Fed is smart. Bernanke has a beard. He can print money. He doesn't know how to do this. He doesn't know how really to make a negative interest rate. And that's a problem for the Fed, right? The Fed, you know, the economy is still slowed down. There's a lot of political pressure on the Fed to try to undertake more expansionary policies and to try to get the economy moving again. The Fed's policy is to set an interest rate, to set the federal funds interest rate. They've pegged it at zero. They've promised to keep it at zero for the foreseeable future. But you know, the Taylor rule says that's not expansionary enough, that we actually need like a negative interest rate here. And that's not something that the Fed can easily do or accomplish. So one thing that this problem is, that we've hit this zero bound and that's stopping the effectiveness of monetary policy, one thing that that's caused a lot of economists and a lot of social analysts and bloggers to talk about are alternative targets of monetary policy. Rather than using monetary policy, open market operations, to try to hit an interest rate, we could use the same techniques, open market operations, to try to hit a different target. The Fed really only has two tools. They can change the total quantity of reserves in the banking system, and they can make public announcements. That's really what they can do. In terms of actually physically doing something, it's really just changing reserves. But they could change reserves to try to hit a different target. So there are two targets that have been suggested a lot recently, an inflation target and a nominal GDP target. Nominal GDP is just the sum of inflation plus real growth. So if inflation was 3% and the economy was growing at 2%, nominal GDP would be growing at 5%. The idea of an inflation target is set a target at, say, like 3% and shoot for steady, stable inflation at 3%. If inflation is at 3%, it's very unlikely that interest rates will get down to zero, and the Fed should always have room to have an easing monetary policy in a crisis. Because it's politically, one reason I think, because it's politically very unpopular for a Fed official to say, hey, we're going to target higher inflation, right? Ron Paul would go insane. So for some reason, if just for political expediency, people will say we should target nominal GDP. Right? If you figure that real growth is more or less given and the Fed mainly controls inflation, calling it nominal GDP target is a more politically acceptable way to say inflation target. It's an interesting question right now if the Fed even could raise inflation a lot. Remember, I showed you the Fed's balance sheet. They've gone from $850 billion up to $3 trillion. That's how much extra reserves they've pumped into the banking system. And we have very low inflation now. So if the Fed wanted to hit an inflation target of 5%, say, it's not completely obvious that they could do that. Larry Summers, famous economist, famous bad guy economist, right? The guy from Harvard, is the president of Harvard, that said women were no good at science or something like that. Right, he has claimed, he was the head of the Economic Council for Obama for a while, he has claimed that the Fed can't do this, right? That the Fed right now is in a position where they couldn't make inflation be high. Because remember, what the Fed does is they pump money into the banking system in the form of reserves, and what we've been seeing is the banking system is holding those reserves in terms of excess reserves. So it's not getting out into the economy. The argument against that, Krugman's argument against that, Paul Krugman, Brad DeLong, liberal economists and progressive bloggers, is that all the Fed really has to do is make people believe they're going to create inflation, right? That it's all about expectations and credibility. So if the Fed announces we're going to have 5% inflation in the future, people will start thinking, wow, inflation's going up in the future, I better spend my money now. The problem with that, in my opinion, is just like in the 1980s when the Fed promised to lower inflation from a history of high inflation, no one believed them. In the 2000s and 10s, when the Fed promises to raise inflation from a 20-year history of low inflation, it's pretty unlikely that anyone will really believe them and take that very seriously. Right? The Fed has spent 20, 25 years building up anti-inflation credibility, sort of to atone for their sins of the 1970s. Right? And the idea that the Fed could simply make an announcement of high inflation in the future and have that be fully credible and have people act on those expectations and believe it, to me, is sort of problematic. So can the Fed do more to try to stimulate the real economy? My answer to that question would be no. There are things they can try. They're very unlikely to be successful. And my reasoning for pointing to that would just be pointing to that $1.4 trillion of reserves sitting there in excess reserves. And the fact that the Fed has, you know, that's what the Fed does, right? They increase reserves. And that's been happening, and we haven't seen much in the way of economic response. That's it for me, except to show you pictures, right? This is Alan Greenspan. This is Paul Volcker, the guy in the 1980s that reduced inflation and caused the huge recession. And this is Ben. Happy to take questions or comments or have a discussion about anything you guys want to talk about.
We have time for a question or two, or a comment. A correction.
Bill?
All right. Please.
To whom is the Fed accountable?
So the Fed was created in 1913 by the U.S. Congress. Right? It was a simple piece of legislation. Was voted on, just a majority vote in Congress. So it's created by the Congress.
But do we have any direct control on them?
There are banking and finance committees in both houses of the Congress that hold regular hearings. Bernanke goes in twice a year by law and testifies in front of those committees. Ron Paul is the chair of the House Banking and Finance Committee. Every 6 months, Bernanke has to go in there. Every 6 months, Ron Paul gives him hell. Every 6 months, Bernanke evades and tries to make nice and get out of there with his skin. So that happens. Okay. Congress can, at any time they want, pass a law saying we're going to have a nominal GDP target, pass a law saying we're going back on the gold standard, pass a law saying the Fed should follow an inflation target. Congress has chosen not to do that. Partly, I think, because evading, having the Fed be this independent agent makes it easier for elected officials to evade political fallout from unpleasant or unpopular monetary policies. Look at the Fed right now. Everybody hates them. Right? Ron Paul and the people on the right are just raging at the Fed for pumping all these reserves and being so expansionary. Krugman and liberal politicians on the left are raging at the Fed for not doing more to help the economy. So the Fed is just sort of like an all-purpose whipping boy for elected politicians, in my opinion, and that's valuable to politicians. Right? If they were to pass a law saying, you've got to do this, then the responsibility for that would devolve not on the Fed, but on the authors of the law.
Yes. Let me say, Professor Garris, being a bit modest, he has some pretty famous research that shows that changes in the composition of the oversight committees of the House and Senate are at least correlated with changes in the monetary policy and open market operations of the Federal Reserve. So that's somewhat controversial, but he has demonstrated that the Fed might not be quite as independent as the zealots who say it's completely independent would say. If Congress wants something, Congress gets it. Is that...
I would amend that to say if, like, people with oversight authority or people that have invested in that area, yeah, then I would agree.
Well, if Congress unanimously wanted something, the Fed would do it.
Sure.
Because they can kill them.
It doesn't even have to be unanimous, just veto-proof, yeah. Assuming the president would even veto. Yeah.
So it's not true the Fed can do whatever it wants. The Fed can do whatever it wants as long as Congress doesn't say no. Now, it generally doesn't say no, and the reason that he just gave is a great one. It's extremely valuable to have them to blame.
It's another point about why it's odd that, like, intelligent, otherwise very intelligent economists would be recommending that the Fed just pick a new policy rule. Right? The U.S. House would go nuts. If the Fed announced that they were going to have a 4% inflation target, there would be bills coming out of the U.S. Congress immediately to abolish the Fed, to cut the Fed's earning, to fire economists at the Fed, to recall Bernanke. I mean, it's just, from a political point of view, right? The Fed is constrained in what they could feasibly announce that they're going to do. And setting an inflation target where the inflation number is higher than 2 would cause all hell to break loose in the Republican Congress.
So at one time, Professor Greer was persona non grata among a lot of the zealots who said that the Fed was independent, and now it's much more accepted. So it went from he's wrong to we all know that.
Any other questions or comments?
All right, well, thanks. Thanks for coming.